What foods are going to be irradiated?
Basically, just about all foods, with the exception of dairy products, fruits, vegetables, meats. Spices, of course, have been irradiated for years. I don't think the public is aware of the fact that spices have been irradiated for quite a few years, and now the current FDA regulation is going to allow something like 3 times the normal dosage that was done before, which brings it up to about 3 million rads of irradiation.
Food irradiation can cause tumors, cataracts, kidney damage, chromosome damage, fewer offspring, mutations.
It has that potential, yes.
Disease-producing organisms.
One of my favorite examples is the cans of chicken stew, for example. The chicken can be irradiated, the wheat flour that goes in there, the potatoes, the onions, the carrots, and the spices can all be irradiated, and you'll not know it. If once food irradiation gets going, that by like 1990, for example, they're predicting like 1,000 of these food irradiation facilities being in place in the United States.
Well, the world can be even a scarier place than it already is, as we find out about food irradiation on Alternative Views. Tonight on Alternative Views, we're going to talk about what has been termed the greatest single technological threat to the health and welfare of the planet, next to actual nuclear war. God, that's scary, ain't it? Well, maybe it is time to be scared, because we're talking about food, and we're talking about food irradiation. If the government has its way and the industry has its way, you're going to be eating irradiated food, and just about nothing else but irradiated food. We're going to have a discussion with a couple of people who know a lot about this. Dr. James Ebert is an author, lecturer, researcher, professional health and nutritional consultant, and a counselor in private practice here in Austin. He's also director of the Central Texas chapter of the National Coalition to Stop Food Irradiation. He also has a book he's trying to get published without success yet called Truth About Food Irradiation. And we also have with us Dr. Michael Heffernan, who is a health educator. He has his doctorate from UCLA, and he's in private practice in Austin. After we did our original interview with Michael Heffernan and James Ebert, Michael came up with some new information a few weeks later, which we wanted to include into the program. So we did a subsequent interview, which will intercut with the relevant parts of our original interview. Hope it's not too confusing.
The first time we did a news story on this subject, the camera person said, "My gosh, you guys have done some terrible, depressing stories in the past." And I've kind of got used to it week after week, year after year, but you guys top yourself now, talking about food irradiation. And it is scary. Can you tell us what it is?
Food irradiation has more than one definition, in a sense, depending upon who you're coming from or who you're talking to. Actually, in essence, it is the exposing of foodstuffs to ionizing radiation, which ionizing radiation is nuclear radiation, gamma radiation.
Tell us, how does irradiation actually work?
Well, it's like any other high ionizing process in which high energy is blasted into a cell. It creates all kinds of molecular derangements. And
now, the Federal Register states as to why they want to expose the foodstuffs to food to this irradiation is to inhibit the growth and nutrition of fresh foods and to disinfect foods of pests.
You mean they're saying that we've been eating pests and all this other bad stuff and all the time, all these past years, but now irradiation is going to take care of it and we're going to be all right?
Well, there are some that are looking at it as being a panacea for all these things that we've been so far in some ways living with or controlling in other means.
What is being irradiated now, and do we know at the store when we buy it if it's irradiated?
Well, that's what's being irradiated now as you and I are speaking here right now are spices on a wholesale level.
That means herbs that people typically buy
herbs
for health
spices.
Purposes as well, right?
Well, they can be. We don't know that because they're on a wholesale level, and there are no records kept as to where these spices are going after they've left the irradiation facility. So
That's
you and
incredible.
I may have eaten some already, and there may be some in products on the food market shelf at the moment. We don't know that.
What are the plans for irradiating food then?
Basically, just about all foods, with the exception of dairy products, fruits, vegetables, meats, spices, of course, have been irradiated for years. I don't think the public is aware of the fact that spices have been irradiated for quite a few years, and now the current FDA regulation is going to allow something like 3 times the normal dosage that was done before, which brings it up to about 3 million rads of irradiation.
What are some of the nutrient losses as a result of radiation?
Well, there are several, and this is a very interesting area because it depends upon the level of radiation. But at the level at which the FDA has planned to expose our food, there are nearly 20 to 70% losses in vitamin C, for example, in certain irradiated foods such as orange juice. We have losses of amino acids such as tryptophan or tryptophan. Methionine is destroyed. There are different B vitamins that are destroyed, such as niacin, B1, B2, lost in anywhere from 10 to 50%. So again, depending on the level of radiation, but at the levels they're currently proposing, we have considerable amounts of nutrient losses. And there are even other studies to show that, of course, cooking does some of this, but we've found from studies that if you irradiate a food and then cook it, that the losses that you get in your nutrient content are more than additive, which means that instead of just adding up the losses you get from cooking and irradiating, you've got a sort of multiplying effect. So basically, since most people do cook their food, we're dealing with a substantial nutritional loss in available nutrients from irradiation.
The propensity for rancidity is enhanced after irradiation. So any oils can become rancid much easier after irradiation than before.
We know that rancid oils have been connected epidemiologically to the incidence of cancer, for example.
That's true.
Okay, so I've read where there are certain things that are produced, something called aflatoxins or aflatoxins, and something called unique radiolytic products or ERPs. What is this?
Well, aflatoxin.
I don't want to eat an ERP, I tell you that.
Well, let's cover each one individually. An aflatoxin is a mold, and it's a carcinogenic producing mold that occurs on things like stored peanuts, for example, when they're stored in moist conditions. There's not a lot known about aflatoxins because their presence were only discovered back in the 60s, and they've been studied. What it's been understood to this point in time is that irradiation seems to clear the field on the product that's been irradiated, thereby allowing the aflatoxins kind of a free rein and to grow easier on a product where they might have been held in check by a natural enemy prior to the irradiation.
So in other words, the radiation has eliminated the microbial competition to such an extent that the one that does real well on the irradiated food makes this nasty stuff, which has been shown to be linked to cancer production in animals, for example.
Yeah, at the levels of exposure that we're speaking of at the moment, the aflatoxins are not affected by the irradiation, whereas their microbial enemies are.
And what about the ERPs?
The ERPs, URP, stands for Unique Radiolytic Products. And whenever food is exposed to a radiation source, radiolytic products are produced. When food is exposed to gamma radiation, ionizing radiation, which we're talking about here for food irradiation, some 43 what are termed unique radiolytic products are formed. And the reason they're termed unique is that they're unique to this technology, and at this point in time, nobody's really understands what they end up as. They begin as a, what's called an URP, or URP, unique radiolytic product, and what they migrate into is anybody's guess in some respects. They begin as a free radical, which a URP is a free radical, and they migrate into something. Now, a lot of them are just absorbed into the hydrogen or the carbon molecules that are available and change into other ingredients which may or may not be harmful.
Free radicals. Now, that sounds like something that J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI would be after. But what are free radicals?
They are a group of molecular substances which have uncombined electrons, and that means that they have an affinity or propensity to grab on to cellular components and change those cellular components to grab off that extra electron. And this creates oxidizing effects in the tissues, which is pretty much, like I mentioned earlier, at a molecular level of shooting bullets through a cell. If you can imagine your cell membrane having lots of holes in it, having parts that are not operating properly, all the way through to the nucleus. And of course, when it hits the nucleus, you have derangement of the genetic code, which is a real dangerous process, oftentimes leading to cancer.
We know that unpaired electrons, or what we call, quote, free radicals, or oxidizing agents, are clearly linked in the aging research to a progression and series of changes in the immune system that cause an organism to age more rapidly, the immunity to decline, and so forth. So we have a big literature on so-called free radicals. In fact, that's been one of the major proposals to account for the aging effect. So essentially, what we're looking at here is an increased concentration of these things in food.
Now, I have seen some places where they say the FDA and other people who are for irradiation would say, well, irradiation food will be safe because all the bad effects go away after a few days or weeks.
Well, obviously, with the nutrient loss, that's not true, because once the nutrients are lost, they're lost for good. The food can't regenerate them because the food is dead. The other thing that makes that a very misleading statement is the FDA has no guidelines established for the length of time necessary to hold a food in storage after it's been irradiated. And we know from the Indian study, for example, and other studies, in the follow-up studies with mice, rats, and monkeys, that these so-called radiolytic products that act like bullets that are produced by the food irradiation process, the free radicals that we talked about, last for quite a few days. And the question is, if they're in there and there's no regulation to establish a waiting period, that people could literally be eating these radiolytic products right after they'd been exposed within several hours afterwards, which means they're getting quite a substantial dose. And one also has to remember that we're dealing with something over a lifetime here. We're dealing with people talking about feeding people over a lifespan of 75 years on the average right now, substantial amounts of radiolytic products, which are additive in their effects in terms of cellular damage.
There have been a lot of studies which have been made about various aspects of the harmful aspects of food irradiation. What about food sugars? Have any of these studies talked about that?
Well, most of the studies, quite a few been done on food sugars, have shown that there are specific types of radiolytic products that come from the exposure of sugar to food irradiation devices, such as sugars such as fructose we find in fruits and vegetables, and even sugars like sucrose, which is a disaccharide that is usually added to food. Some of these radiolytic products have been shown to arrest normal cell development and cause many of the same processes that the perioxidized lipids or fats that have been irradiated also show. And of course, since sugar is such a prevalent food, it becomes even more dangerous from the point of view of exposure.
What have some of the studies about food irradiation shown as far as reproduction?
Well, we know from studies on insects, for example, and the reason they use insects like fruit flies is because they regenerate so quickly that it's easy in a short period of time to see the effect over several generations, whereas in humans, obviously, it takes large amounts of time. What we find in these insect populations that have been eating irradiated food as compared to eating the same food, exactly the same food, that has not been irradiated, is that there's a decrease in offspring and to the factor of about 2. So there's an effect on offspring and also on chromosome abnormalities.
Hmm. Does that have to do with cell division?
It has to do with the cell division. Also has to do with the viability of the germ cells that are found in the insect or in the animal. And these studies have also been shown to be true in rodent populations. So we're going up the phylogenetic scale. We find that, sure enough, that in rodent populations that the same phenomena seems to be happening.
I love what has happened in a lot of cases where the people who are for food irradiation or the FDA will ignore so many of the facts that a previous study has shown, or they will distort the information which they received. For instance, there was one where they were doing it with pups, with dogs, and they were trying to do it on a 2-year period so they could get the reproductive cycle and see what would happen. Well, they were feeding these poor animals irradiated food, and all of them died within 9 months. And so they couldn't carry it out, but they said, well, it proved what we wanted to prove anyway. It shows the food irradiation's okay. All the damn animals died.
Yeah. Well, they also have a little trick where there was another study that was being done. They cut it short by a factor of about 15 months, and nobody knows why they did that, but they still were showing dangerous effects of food irradiation. But because they had originally planned the study for 2 years, they had figured that if that would be the minimum amount of time to show some kind of effects, and yet they went ahead and published the results on a 9-month basis, which is pretty silly. It doesn't show a very good scientific method.
Yeah. People have been told that food irradiation can cause tumors, cataracts, kidney damage, chromosome damage, fewer offspring, mutations.
It has that potential, yes.
Disease-producing organisms, and a lot of things they don't even know, because when irradiation acts upon the chemicals that are already been added to the foods before processing, nobody knows what's going to be produced because of the interaction between the irradiation and the chemical.
Or we could talk about things as mundane as radioactive cockroaches that they found that get in around the
plants.
Places that get involved with radioactivity, and these cockroaches become radioactive, and then their excrement becomes they leave little mounds of radioactive excrement around. And we're talking about the potential of flies flying in the food irradiation facility becoming radioactive and flying
out
of the home.
Insects have been known to adapt to high levels of radiation, genetically modify themselves.
And who in the food industry is actually pushing this?
There is what is called the Coalition for Food Irradiation. And this is made up of biggies in the food industry. I've got a list here which includes people like the Alpo Pet Food Company, for example, Beatrice Grocery Group, Campbell Soup, Del Monte, Gaines Pet Food, General Foods, Gerber, Heinz, Hershey's, Kraft, Thomas Lipton's, Mars, McCormick and Company, National Food Processors Association, National Pork Producers.
Yeah. The biggest food corporations.
Yeah, we're talking about
pushing
it.
This.
The cream of the crop here, so to speak. And these people are looking for ways to promote shelf life.
This is the sole justification which they give for food irradiation, isn't it?
Well, I wouldn't suggest that it's the sole, but it's
the main one, to extend shelf life.
That's one of the aspects. And also the idea of sterilization. If they can, that would in itself extend shelf life. But like the pork producers, for example, they're offering the promise of being able to eat pork rare, for example. You know, like a rare beefsteak.
Dubious benefit.
Right now you have to cook pork in order to be safe to get rid of the trichinosis parasite, which is a very minor problem in this country. I think there's something less than 100 cases a year reported for the whole United States. There are other things too, like are you familiar with the aseptic packaging, these little cubes of drink that you find in the grocery store these days, and also like frozen foods that you can take out of the freezer and dump into your microwave and that sort of thing. They are looking for ways of promoting shelf life on those, because like in military applications, for example, shipping the food from point of origin to the soldier out on the field and that sort of thing, this is all providing a certain amount of impetus towards food irradiation. Proponents of this food irradiation technology are doing whatever they can to get this technology up and running. because we're talking as a huge amount at stake here that has nothing to do with food whatsoever. Which leads into the political aspects of this. One of the prime reasons that food irradiation is being promoted under the surface is because the Department of Energy here in the United States has a tremendous amount of cesium-137 to do something with. It's interesting to notice that since at over 50% of the atomic weapons that are in existence today, right now as you and I are speaking, have come into existence since Ronald Reagan has become president of the United States. Over half.
Wow.
And as a direct byproduct of the manufacture of plutonium, which is utilized in these weapons, is the product cesium-137. And so they've got mountains of this stuff sitting around, and it's the cesium is real hard to store because thermally it's real hot material, as well as being real hot radioactively speaking. And the storage containers that they have, like in the Hanford nuclear reservation up in Washington State, are starting to deteriorate, and so they're hoping that they can get involved with food irradiation, encapsulate the cesium in what's called the WESF capsules, which are triple steel capsules, which are about in this vicinity of being big, something about 16 inches long by about 3 or 4 inches wide, and then distributing these to food irradiation facilities all around the United States. And the current estimates are that if once food irradiation gets going, that by like 1990, for example, they're predicting like 1,000 of these food irradiation facilities being in place in the United States. And all the cesium being in places that, you know, heretofore it's not.
So basically, recently there's been a lot of controversy about where to dump the radioactive waste. You know, they had some proposal that they were going to dump it up in northern Texas, and there was a lot of resistance because there was some possible groundwater contamination. So it seems like instead of dumping it in the ground, they want to just dump it around the country in plants.
Well, this is the next nobody plant. Wants this stuff. Nobody wants it.
This is also a way of justifying or taking the heat and pressure off the nuclear industry and the arms industry, because one of their big sources of criticism is the fact that they produce all this radioactive waste that's going to be in the environment for 250,000 years. And so if they can say, well, look, we're doing food irradiation with it. Don't criticize us for that. You say there are going to be 1,000 by 1990. I would think there'd have to be much, much more than that, because this enormous amount of food is produced and enormous amount of food is consumed every day in this country. Unless these are huge, huge plants, I would think there would have to be many more plants than just 1,000 if they're going to do all the food.
Well, this is just a projection at this moment in time. It's conjecture as to how many there'll be, because these plants are not inexpensive. There's anywhere from $4 to $5 to $6 million capital investiture of just a building alone to get the facility built. And then we're talking about the government's going to be leasing the cesium as opposed to selling it, and that's going to be another X amount of dollars to put the source in too. So we're talking about a fair amount of capitalization involved with putting one of these in.
Well, you know, I imagine none of this would be done without profit, right? None of these corporations would be interested in doing that without profit. And of course, the profit means cost. And the cost usually means to the consumer, with a profit going to the food industry. Mm-hmm. How much of this? Well, two questions. Is the taxpayer going to be bearing the cost of the installation of these things, like the taxpayer bears the cost of nuclear plants and the whole startup of the nuclear power, and of course the Department of Defense? And secondly, is the cost of food going to be higher?
Well, the taxpayer is going to be ultimately subsidizing the cost of this food irradiation by the mere fact that the taxpayer is buying these nuclear armaments that are being produced through the production of the plutonium, and the cesium being a byproduct of the plutonium production. Industry is going to be paying for the food irradiation. They're the ones that are going to have to go to their bankers and etc., raising money in order to build the facilities. But then the consumer is going to come along and bear the brunt of higher cost for things. It's predicted that food irradiation will raise the cost of foodstuffs anywhere from a nickel to a dime a pound over what it is now. Mm. And that is considered by many to be conservative.
I've seen them a lot higher than that. Haven't you read some things that...
Yeah, I've read some estimates up to 15 cents a pound, but we know from
or
the...
25.
We know from the track record of the nuclear industry that we pretty well can count on multiplying by so many times their actual estimates, because our track record in terms of nuclear plant installation and so forth has been considerably beyond what they originally thought, too.
One of the things we've learned about nuclear energy is that the plants that produce nuclear energy are themselves very dangerous to the workers, to the environment. There's all sorts of possibilities of catastrophic accidents happening. Would it be the same thing with food irradiation plants?
There have been numerous recorded accidents that are documented by the NRC, and they're in the track record so far. They've got something like 38 facilities in the United States at the moment, and there's been four major accidents, including one near death, where a fellow had walked into the irradiation SARS chamber because management had usurped the safety devices. In fact, as this particular management person had usurped it enough, the NRC demanded his ouster as president of his own company because he was so callous.
Isn't he now been rehired to run a food irradiation facility in Hawaii?
Well, no, he hasn't been hired to run it. He's been hired by the DOE as a consultant.
Great.
Well, I read where, as far as emission standards go, that the Nuclear Regulatory Agency permits them to be 20 times as well. How can I put this right?
The neighbors of an irradiation facility can receive up to 20 times more radiation than the neighbors of a nuclear power plant.
Right. Okay. It's 20 times more dangerous than a nuclear power plant as far as that standard goes.
You live next to it.
As far as the neighbors living next to it, as far as a an accident occurring, an irradiation facility will not have the propensity of an accident like a Chernobyl, for example.
Right.
There will not be a meltdown availability, because we're not talking about a critical mass here.
No, it'll just be a subtle poisoning.
It goes into the water supply
like it did in Ohio, or into the groundwater in Hawaii like it did in the accident in Hawaii, and people are just slowly...
Well, what we had is a documented case up in New Jersey where they had to drain the storage pool, and the storage pool has water in it, and this water becomes contaminated, nuclear, radioactively contaminated over a period of time. And there was an accident where they had to drain this pool of water in order to fix it. Well, they drained it overnight, and the pump was unattended, and the hose fell off the pump, and as a result, the 5,700 liters of water was on the floor the next morning when they came into the plant. Well, management instructed the cleanup crew to take that 5,700 liters of water and dispose of it through the sewer system, the public
radioactive water.
We're talking about radioactivity also of, I believe, either cobalt-60 or is it cesium-137?
It was cobalt-60.
This was
cobalt-60. Well, that has a half-life of 5 years, so we've got that stuff out in the environment for 5 years, at least half of it.
Well, the water wouldn't necessarily have a half-life of 5.2 years. It's I don't know what the half-life of the water was, but it was contaminated with radioactivity.
Well, the very first accident was in Hawaii in 1967, where they had one of the early food irradiation plants, and cobalt-60 escaped into the water source in 1967. They closed down the plant, tried to clean it up, but 13 years later, in 1980, there was still high levels of radiation when people went over both the ground and the water with Geiger counters. So this has a long life and very high toxic danger levels of radiation.
Well, cobalt-60 is a very strong emitter.
You know, there's another potential danger here we haven't talked about, and that is if you have all these plants around the country, you've got to get the material to them, the cesium-137, et cetera. So you're going to have trucks going all around the country.
That's another whole issue, and that is the transportation of nuclear materials on our nation's highways at unprecedented rates.
I think most communities have clearly, where there's been voting taken place, like up in Colorado and so forth, have expressly put laws forth to try and stop the transportation of nuclear waste or nuclear materials through their highway systems. So how are they going to be transporting this stuff? Are they going to drop it in with a helicopter?
And then they have these caskets that the product is supposedly sealed in, and they're supposedly accident-proof. I mean, they supposedly had tested these things by running locomotive engines into them, and they've not been damaged. But it's, to me, it's kind of like the old Coke bottle theory. If you've ever taken the old Coke bottle, and you could throw it up against the wall, and it bounces off, but then it just falls off the table, and it shatters into a million pieces. So. A worst-case scenario would be one of these truckloads of cesium, which is a chloride salt, which is very water-soluble, having an accident over an area like the Edwards Aquifer here in Austin during a rainstorm, and the cesium just percolating its way down through the soil. And now this is a far-fetched worst case, but it is within the probability factor of, since the transportation, et cetera, this percolating through the soil and contaminating the Edwards Aquifer, at least for 30-some-odd years, that aquifer would not be able to be used for anything. I mean, people in Barton Springs, for example, would not be able to bathe in that water.
Well, you wouldn't be able to drink.
You wouldn't be able to tap it off for water, and all the people downstream from that would be just out of water source for a lot of years.
I think it's important to point out to the viewers also that when they say half-life, that means that's the time period in which half of the substance is used up. That doesn't mean it's gone after 30 years.
No, it's
another 30 years, another half. So you have half of what the original exposure was at the end of 30 years, which probably in all likelihood is going to be extremely radioactive also. So 30 years is, forget it. We're talking about, you know, lifetimes here.
There was an article in The Nation about this, and it says, why is the Department of Energy for food irradiation? It's written by Ken Terry in February 7, 1987. It says that the U.S. government is promoting food irradiation to justify the extraction of plutonium from commercial nuclear wastes for use in nuclear weapons. It goes on to say that, you're familiar with this article too.
I'm familiar with
that. Two things are happening. There's so much nuclear waste being built up by these nuke plants, they don't know what to do with it, and it's an Achilles heel. People say, hey, you know, you got all that stuff, it's bad. But, and on the other hand, Reagan has built up so many nuclear armaments that they didn't have enough plutonium for the stuff that they're going to be running out of it. So they've got to be able to marry the commercial production with the nuclear armaments.
The problem in this incestuous relationship is that the quantity of plutonium that's produced in a nuclear reactor is equally and proportional to the quantity of cesium-137. So if the cesium-137, all of a sudden there's a need for the cesium-137 that's commercially demonstrated, and we've got several thousand radiation plants, by the way, which are already in plan, several of them, the initial ones, then you see you have already demonstrated a need for cesium-137, so thereby you have to go through the process by which you produce it in the nuclear reactor, thereby you get more plutonium. That plutonium then becomes used by the armament industry to increase the nuclear armament arsenal and so forth. So it's an insidious relationship, as I mentioned before, and one that probably most of the public is not aware of. And, of course, I'm sure that most of the powers to be don't want them to be aware of it.
Yeah, so it says here in this article that while all of the Department of Energy-owned cesium would supply only 50 irradiation plants, their estimates of the commercial fuel waste contain 1.2 billion curies of cesium-137. And so the DOE could use this food irradiation as a rationale for reprocessing of commercial spent fuel.
Absolutely. And I'm sure that's what the intention is. And it makes perfect sense because only a few months ago on the news there was all this debate about where to put the subterranean disposal site. First of all, it was thought to be we were going to put it in Nevada, and there were certain objections to that. Then, of course, the tourist trade in Nevada would be hurt. I don't know if you remember seeing on TV, but 2020 and some 60 Minutes, some of these middle-of-the-road types
of approaches had viewed some of this, and then they talked about Washington State and all the problems they had around the Hanford reactor with the leakage and so forth, and how that would be an inappropriate site. So now we don't see much more of this about where they're going to select the site, and I think it's partly because they've decided that food irradiation is probably the site, and so instead of sticking it all in one big hole, they're going to spread it around the whole country so every neighborhood can have their hot food irradiation plant, which gets back to your question about what are some of the possible environmental hazards. Well, how would you like to have a cesium-137 plant next door to you? Do you know that the half-life of cesium-137 is 35 years? If you get it in your body, you're cooked. You know, you've had it. It's equally as dangerous as, I mean, considering the human lifespan of an average 75 years, which I think is foreshortened because of all of our bad health practices. But at any rate, 35 years is half of that. So if you have half of your life full of radioactive waste in your body, you've had it. Well, they talk a lot about radioactive iodine. It has a half-life of something like 1 or 2 days. And after the Chernobyl incident, you know, I called up the EPA in Washington, D.C., and I said, you know, how much radioactivity do you have in the environment? They said, well, we have a certain amount of radioactive iodine. I says, what about radioactive cesium? They didn't know. They weren't measuring it. What about plutonium? They didn't know. They weren't measuring it. Then later we find out in the news media that these sheep farmers in Great Britain have had to cancel their contracts, sales contracts, because their sheep are radioactive. And remember that the half-life of radioactive iodine is only a few days, and these sheep are radioactive for months and months and months, which means that they've gotten another isotope into their bodies from the Chernobyl incident, which is, you know, quite a distance from Chernobyl. And that tells you that, hey, we're not measuring these things, but cesium is probably one of these products that's being dumped into the grasslands of Great Britain and ending up in the sheep carcasses and bodies. And of course, they're quite irate because they can't sell their sheep. The meat is no good for sale. The wool is radioactive. It's got a 35-year isotope in it that would cook you if you put it on you, you know, over a period of time. These are low levels, but they're still levels enough to do damage. So how would you like to have one of those plants next door? You know, that's the problem. And I don't care how safe they are. The track record has been notoriously poor. There have been two food irradiation plants that have already leaked. And as I understand, they reinstituted some of these airplane flight carriers that used to carry radioactive plutonium. In fact, there was an accident several years ago in which they went down in Greenland and they crashed, and this plutonium spread all over the darn place up there, Iceland or Greenland. Yeah. And they sent in several governmental agents from different countries, and now most of them end up with cancer. So, hey, cleaning this mess up would be something if one of these food irradiation plants were to leak. Or if in the process of transporting some of this stuff, this 137, to a food irradiation plant in your neighborhood should leak, well, hey, you know, that's too bad, right?
Another dimension to this is reported by the Australian nuclear magazine, or anti-nuclear environmental magazine, Chain Reaction, that reports that consumer groups as far away as Malaysia see the growth of irradiation faculties in the third world being a growing trend that would allow the U.S. to dump its nuclear wastes in the third world and to irradiate food there.
So and to have the American taxpayer finance it.
Right.
And
so
the consumer
why do you
finance
have to
it?
Transport all across the ocean and to the other side of the world all this radioactive material? Then, of course, you're dumping on another country your waste that you want to get rid of, which is another dimension of this.
There's an organization which is a wing of the United Nations, which is the International Atomic Energy IAEA, and they are promoting food irradiation around the world. There is currently food irradiation of potatoes only in Japan. There are some irradiated products in the Netherlands, but since consumers protested in both countries, have reevaluated their feeling on food irradiation. In Great Britain, there's great controversy going on now. There's nothing happening in Great Britain, and if the consumer keeps up their activities that they're doing now, there won't be anything in Great Britain. I have here, for instance, a feasibility study produced for the Caribbean area, which outlines the implementation of food irradiation facilities throughout the Caribbean, which includes Belize, Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Costa Rica, the Canal Zone, Jamaica, Haiti, Puerto Rico. Now they're looking to put irradiation facilities in all these countries, and it's kind of like we'll be spreading this stuff out, but then we'll also be getting it back.
Right.
Now, you've talked to a lot of retailers of stores that will be carrying or maybe carrying now some of this stuff. What's their attitude?
It's incredibly frightening because most of the retail outlets, such as here in Texas, we have HEB and Safeway and Tom Thumb. They're mostly ignorant about what food irradiation is, and they have even very little knowledge about what the process might involve or how it might affect consumers. They have no understanding about how they might ask their suppliers as to whether a food has been irradiated. In other words, they've taken the whole responsibility and thrown it over to the FDA, and of course the FDA has nowhere the amount of resources to check on where foods are coming from and so forth. So the result of that is that people are literally being misinformed or not informed in their position. They're in a position of responsibility, the retailers and the wholesalers of food, and yet they seem to be some of the most ignorant in regard to the processes. For example, I got back from one retail store chain, I think it was Tom Thumb, a sort of crystallized propagandic summary of what food irradiation was, and there was so much misinformation in it, I had to just put it aside because, number one, there were no scientific references in it anywhere, and it was all this opinionated stuff about how it's just like pasteurizing food or cooking it, and there's no more danger than you would find through pasteurization. That's the kind of whitewash that's being given to this topic.
Of course, let's face it, the big food chains, they're not in the health business. They're in the business of selling food. They're marketeers. And so they really, you know, yeah. unless the public screams about it, they really don't care, so long as they get their profit out of it.
Well, I brought up the issue of possible class action suits that might be filed against wholesale and retail food distributors if, in fact, people begin to find they're having an increased incidence of cancer or effects in terms of reproductive capacity or whatever, which might be expected, obviously, from the animal studies. And even from the studies, there have been some done on humans. And their response was, well, if enough consumers show a lack of interest in buying this product, we may, in fact, drop it. But the question of them even knowing when it comes into their store, I mean, the whole issue of labeling is such a whitewash. You know, the way the government's trying to handle it, they're just completely neglecting being honest about labeling it. They want to call it pico waving, and they don't even want to label the stuff that is in packages, and they don't seem to want to require that these packages be labeled even though they've been irradiated. So how are the retailers going to know?
The federal regulation states that any foods, whole foods, are, as Michael was talking about, first generation foods that are irradiated, have to be identified with a label that says treated with ionizing radiation and a little symbol called the radura. If you'll notice, it's a little flower-like symbol surrounded by a little circle. It's very much similar to the EPA's symbol, for example. But anyway, this is the radura.
Now, kind of a happy face symbol. Who would ever guess that has anything to do with the radiation?
And
of course,
also,
that's the intent, is to defraud people in a way.
The mandated color is green, too, which is the go color. Green. As of April of 1987, the wording requirement drops and only the symbol requirement remains. Now, there's no provisions in the federal regulations as they stand now as to what size that symbol need be. Theoretically, they could get by legally by putting it on the size of a pinhead.
Get out your microscopes.
And unless the media picks up on this and makes it clear to the public what this symbol means and what's going on in food radiation, people won't even know what it means anyway.
Well, of course, the media is going to be fed information from this coalition for food irradiation.
They already have
people.
Been.
And they're touting it out as being the symbol of purity, the symbol that represents wholesomeness.
As the regulation now states that they will drop that little sign after a year or something?
No, the regulation says that after April of 1987, that that's the only thing that need be applied. And regarding the second generation foods, as you say, processed foods, ingredients to processed foods, one of my favorite examples is the cans of chicken stew, for example. The chicken can be irradiated, the wheat flour that goes in there, the potatoes, the onions, the carrots, and the spices can all be irradiated, and you'll not know it because there's no need for that to be placed on the can label.
And when you go to a restaurant, that there's no protection whatsoever there.
That's another whole
that's
aspect.
Wide open,
the restaurateur is not required by law or any other entity to identify the foodstuffs that he's using as have been being irradiated. And in fact, he may not even know of some of the things, such as in the case right now with wholesale spices. If you go to your local pizzeria, for example, and order a pizza, you may have already eaten some irradiated spices and not even know it. And that fella that's making the pizza, when he bought the spices in a can, he doesn't know it either.
Let's talk now about what can be done about it. There are two levels, one the political level, and there is some action in Congress about this, and then after we talk about that, then we can talk about what individuals can do.
The strongest thing that's going on right at this moment in time is a bill that's been presented by Douglas Bosco, who's a representative from the state of California. This is on the national level. This is in the U.S. House of Representatives. The bill number is H.R. 956, and it, in summary, will place a moratorium on food irradiation, but in specific, it will block the current implementation of the Federal Food and Drug Administration regulation that allows food irradiation until such time as studies be conducted on the health effects of eating irradiated food, the environmental consequences from transportation of the radioactive materials, and the dangers that are posed to workers at irradiation facilities.
But I think the real pressure has to come from an individual choice level of each consumer starting to question their grocer, starting to question their store managers where they buy their produce, about where they get it, how they know it hasn't been irradiated, and to voice their protest that they want to stay healthy as best they can and to not eat irradiated food. This has to be sort of an individual effort. The other possibility I see is to develop some means that individual consumers or consumer groups can test food and sample it from various sources to determine its safety standards as in terms of being irradiated or not being irradiated. And this almost has to be like a Ralph Nader approach, I think, because if we look to the FDA to do this, one, they don't have the resources. Number two, they have vested interests. They're connected with the other governmental agencies which have vested interests in making food processing food irradiation plants. So they're not particularly interested. So we have to take it in our own hands and exert pressure both at a local level and maybe if you can think of also sending letters to your congressman, that's going to help, obviously.
What if people bought directly from the farmer or farmers' markets? Then they would that be able to bypass the irradiation system?
I think that's probably one of the best suggestions you can give people because it does many things politically that protect your health. Number one, it ensures survival of the American farmer, the small farmer that is making high-quality produce for human consumption that has some sense of quality control and pride in their workmanship. They are certainly in need of that financial assistance. So by directly buying from the farmer, I used to live up in Indiana and I lived on an organic produce farm and the man there had a large farm market where everybody would come from town and buy directly. That sort of system is far superior to keeping the control at a local community level in terms of the food chain. It's better in terms of keeping diversification that's necessary in a rural environment to ecologically support the planet. So from many different perspectives, it makes a lot of sense.
As a result of calling the supermarket chain quality manager control people, they seem to be sensitive to consumer pressure more than anything. And I would suggest, this may sound a bit far out, but I would suggest people buying a personal Geiger counter radiation detection device. And I say this in all seriousness because we've had enough documented accidents such as the one up in Ohio into the water supply where many people now that wanted to sit back and hope the government would take care of them found out later that their water is radioactive. Could have prevented this whole scenario to some extent if they had kept on top of it themselves by monitoring. In fact, the Hawaiian plant that leaked was monitored by consumer groups, and that's how they finally got the government to go and clean it up. The government doesn't seem to be responsible to clean up their mess. And I think if each person had a Geiger counter, they could know for sure whether their neighborhood was being infected by radioactive waste dumps or whatever, but more importantly, even to check their water supply and their food source, to use it in a consumer market sense to go and check the food, because it's always possible that things could be contaminated. Not that the food is radioactive or not supposed to be radioactive, but contamination is always a possibility.
But this wouldn't let you know whether the food had been irradiated or not.
No, there are other methods that consumers can use for that. In spite of what the government wants to tell us, a simple germination test will tell you whether or not a food has been altered in a damaging way, whether it's the radiation or high chemical treatment or whatever. We know that potatoes sprout if left in the dark long enough. We know that wheat sprouts. We know that apple seeds if taken out and stratified in a cold temperature and then planted should sprout. Vital food, carrots and onions and so forth, we've all seen that in our pantry sprout. When that stops happening, I'm suspicious. And
yes,
I think
but
people
Michael,
ought to watch
there
it.
Are other foods that are proposed for being irradiated, whereby, like grapes, for example, there's no
that
way.
That you can't test. I admit you can't do it at all, but there's quite a few foods that you could actually.
And I wouldn't
germinate.
Necessarily equate the non-sprouting of a potato with the fact that it might have been irradiated.
That's not what I said. What I said is anything that tampered with its genetic mechanism to allow it to sprout, including irradiation. You wouldn't be able to say for sure it had been irradiated, but you would know that that's one of the possibilities. At any rate, I wouldn't suggest eating it.
From what you said earlier, it seems that consumer protests in Japan and in Britain stopped the spreading of food irradiation. So I would think that that would be one of the more efficacious things people could do. They could just militate against irradiation in food and just say we don't want.
Well, and what he's saying about the fact that with the Geiger counter is a strong way. I mean, if you walk into your grocery store, you're going to create a stir if you start checking out the products. But that's not true in the sense that the foodstuffs will be irradiated.
But if you started ticketing your local grocery store that it was determined had irradiated food, then this might be a way of getting them to take it off the shelves because they start losing customers.
Well, see, right now there aren't any products that we know of except now they did mangoes in Florida, one batch, and they did papayas in California. And what happened out in California, the National Coalition found out the stores the papayas were in, and their protesters went there, and as soon as the protesters appeared, these papayas disappeared, if you will, because the market was real sensitive to this. So that's a very strong thing. But right now, one of the strongest things is to contact your representative, whoever that might be, and urge him or her to look at this bill, H.R. 956, and to sign on as a co-sponsor.
I'd like to point out something else, which is under the current regulations, it's quite unlikely that we're going to have an FDA inspector at each plant or in the line of food delivery system checking for possible contamination into the food source. And they certainly weren't able to do it with the uranium reprocessing plant up in Ohio. So why do we expect with 1,000 plants across the country that they will have the manpower or the inclination to go and check the output? And that's why I say individual consumers need to take the initiative on this. And I hope the moratorium works, but for me, I would feel much better in having the whole idea stopped permanently from here to the end of time. I don't think a moratorium that's kind of a watered-down version of saying we don't like it. I think a more permanent version is saying that we're not going to ever have it, because logically it doesn't make sense to begin with. The whole thing is absurd.
For those who choose to maintain information on this, one of the strongest things they can do is to write to the National Coalition and to support what we're doing. And the support looks like A, writing the Congress people, B, going to the food stores and taking action there, C, spreading the word about this, because I'll venture to say that a large portion of the viewing audience heretofore has not heard of this this activity, and this is probably news to them. And so I urge you to consider writing to this address that's on the screen. You can write to me if you choose. Frank, I'd be happy to give you my address. It's right here in Austin, Texas. For those of you who have a pencil and paper and wish to write this down, it's Box 3714, Austin, Texas, 78764.
And I think that once people realize what's happening, they're really going to be upset about this and take some action, because they haven't been told that food irradiation can cause tumors, cataracts, kidney damage, chromosome damage, fewer offspring, mutations.
It has that potential, yes.
Disease-producing organisms.
If anybody out there who eats food, this is an issue that concerns them. And unless you grow the food in your own backyard or in your own plot of ground somewhere, this is definitely an issue that concerns you. And even if you do grow your own food, you still got to concern yourself with the things like the transportation of the nuclear materials. And we're talking about some of the other ancillary issues here.
The real danger I see here is the possibility of large corporate farms developing nearby food irradiation plants, and of course these big corporate farms having a great deal of vested interest, as they're already beginning to show, just taking the total control away from the public in terms of their food chain and the control over their food chain. And pretty soon it's possible to imagine where, given the loss of family farms and the American farmer going out of business in such droves up in the north, that there wouldn't be much variability in terms of where we get our food, and we might just have to get it from these food irradiation plants. We may have no other choice, unless, of course, the public takes an active interest in their own health and realizes what they have to do.
We thank you for watching Alternative Views again. We'd like to see you doing this every week. And we hope you particularly enjoyed the program this time, The Glowing Green Grocer, our program about food irradiation. Many people have asked us to give the names and addresses of the publications which we use for news and other source material. The Guardian is a Marxist publication. The address is 33 West 17th Street, New York, New York, 10011. The Spotlight is a right-wing populist publication, 300 Independence Avenue, Southeast, Washington, D.C., 20003. For keeping up with the CIA and other intelligence organizations, it's the Covert Action Information Bulletin, P.O. Box 50272, Washington, D.C., 20004. The National Reporter also covers the CIA, P.O. Box 21279, Washington, D.C., 20009. In These Times is the Democratic Socialist publication, 1300 West Belmont, Chicago, Illinois, 60657. The Nation is a liberal magazine which has been published for many, many decades. 72 Fifth Avenue, New York, New York, 10011. The Udney Reader is the Reader's Digest of the left, P.O. Box 1974, Marion, Ohio, 43305. Mother Jones is a weekly progressive magazine with considerable circulation, 1663 Mission Street, San Francisco, California, 94103. Alternative Views is a presentation of the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. You'd like to comment on our program? There's our address. We'd be real happy to hear from you. Bye-bye.